From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, it's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, LeVar Burton starred in Roots and Star Trek The Next Generation, but he says neither of those is his biggest role in life.
As much as I love acting and directing and being a storyteller in the visual medium, there isn't anything that I do or have done that fills me with a deep sense of purpose that Reading Rainbow has.
Legendary music producer Butch Vig talks about the downside to the digital revolution.
One of the sad things is the great spaces. A lot of the great studios are slowly closing the doors, and what's going to happen is a lot of artists are never going to get that chance to record in a really great recording studio. You know, they're going to be recording on their laptop in their basement.
And Waukesha-based Ian and the Dream hopes to wow some record companies this week in Milwaukee. Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today.
Butterfly in the sky, I can go twice as high. Take a look, it's in a book, a reading rainbow.
Depending on your age, you likely know LeVar Burton for one of several acting roles he's played on television. He burst into prominence in the late 1970s with the lead role of Kunta Kinte on the miniseries Roots. In the 1980s and 90s, millions knew him and his futuristic eyewear in his role as Geordi LaForge in Star Trek The Next Generation. But the role that stuck with him the longest was himself, as the host of the public television series Reading Rainbow, which aired for 23 years. Burton hosted and was executive producer of the series, which worked to connect kids of many ages to a love of reading through books and video field trips that Burton took. The series went off the air in 2006, but was relaunched digitally in recent years thanks to a Kickstarter campaign that reportedly raised about $5 million in 3 days. LeVar Burton still takes on acting roles now and then, but most of his work these days is in reading and literacy. And that's what will bring him to Milwaukee later this month to speak at Sharp Literacy's annual luncheon. He joins us by phone this morning. LeVar Burton, such a pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks, Mitch.
Before Reading Rainbow, before your acting career, when you were little, what were the books that started it all for you?
The book that I cite when that was the book I was reading when I really like got reading, when it really was cemented and became a part of my DNA, was Captain's Courageous, and I cite that book as the one that really turned me on, because when I came to the end of that book, I was depressed. Is the best way to describe it. I was profoundly sad because I had become so attached to the characters, and I was so enthralled with the world that I had been spending so much time in. When the experience came to an end, it was depressing.
It's interesting to hear you say that, because that's one of the ways that I judge books is, if I get to the point where I realize that I'm going to be sad when this book ends.
Yes. To this day, I slow down. When I know that's going to happen, I try and stave off that inevitable sense of depression, because there's just nothing like surrendering yourself and your imagination to a story well told.
You're talking to us, actually, I think, from a hotel room. Do you have books with you?
I do. I have a library on my iPad. I travel a lot these days, and I travel light, which is to say I travel with a backpack and my carry-on. We have the luxury these days of being able to cart around with us on some sort of tablet reading device or another, an entire library, if we so choose.
And so what is the book that is capturing your attention right now?
I am into the Game of Thrones like you could not believe, or maybe you can. I was up until 4 o'clock this morning reading chapter after chapter after chapter. It's phenomenal.
This is a little like Harry Potter for grown-ups.
It is, and I read the Harry Potter books as well. I mean, storytelling is a part of the fabric of who we are. It is how we, in part, define ourselves as human beings, and there is nothing like connecting our imagination, which is really the superpower that all human beings possess. The ability to imagine a future or a reality outside of the one we are currently in. And when you combine the imagination and really good storytelling, you can literally travel anywhere in the universe.
Well, let's talk about how this meets up with television. Reading Rainbow, of course, had this incredibly long run. Even during that run, there were any number of other television shows, you know, public TV shows and later cable TV shows that took on literacy. What do you think was in the chemical formula of Reading Rainbow that made people react to it the way they did, even long after they were children themselves and even after the show itself went off the air, at least in its new form?
Wow, that's a big question. Well, I think it had something to do. It was a combination of things, clearly. There was the books themselves and the way we presented them, and it was really a great use of the technology of the time of television to move the camera over the otherwise still images in the art of the books themselves and create movement and sort of substitute for the reader's eye in moving the camera across the page. And then the storytelling experience was really powerful because, you know, we used the finest actors and storytellers on the planet to narrate those books. I think the storytelling experience was really well done. We then connected that book or the theme of that book to a real-world experience. And through the video field trip. And that was a real important staple of the show as well. We combined the books with a video field trip experience, thereby giving the child an opportunity to explore the world and identify aspects of the world that they otherwise would not have known or been exposed to. And then there were the testimonials, the book reviews that kids did themselves. And I think that the audience of children saw their peers being excited and enthusiastic about literature that they were happy to share. And that sort of sparked an enthusiasm in them as well. I've got to believe it was a combination of all of those things.
Do you think the show changed the world in some way?
I do. And I say that unashamedly and unabashedly, because I receive evidence of that truth every day of my life. People come up to me, adults now, who grew up on Reading Rainbow, and they always refer to it, dude, that was my childhood, right? I mean, their passion and enthusiasm for not just the show, but the impact that the show had on their lives says to me that we did make a difference. I believe that we, in some small way, had a hand in creating a generation, perhaps two, of adults today who are readers in part because of Reading Rainbow. And for me, that's no small thing.
Lots of other shows have ended, and the people behind them have moved on to other things. Why was this so important to keep going?
This show and what this show is about, which for me is creating readers, creating human beings who are passionate about literature, who are developing the essential skill of becoming a lifelong learner. It's more than a job for me. This is my life. This is my vocation. This is what I feel like I have been put on this earth to do. And I don't believe that it is possible. It's certainly difficult, if not impossible, to develop yourself to your full potential without being a reader. We need to teach our children not just how to read, we also need to teach them how to love reading. And that's why I do this.
As you develop the new version, Reading Rainbow Mark II, if you will, it has both this kind of app component. It is an app component. And also, if I understand it right, you're working on making it into a classroom tool as well. What role do you see the classroom version playing in the context of what schools are already doing as far as reading education and you know, basic literacy skills?
Well, I see that we can be huge support in terms of supplemental reading that is applicable now, especially with Common Core, to all subject matters. It is important we now recognize to teach the whole child and to address our education of our children to them actually living in the world. We are no longer focused on teaching our kids how to take tests. We're teaching them how to learn and appreciate the learning that they're doing by making them better people.
What is it about the reading aspect that is important to you versus your sitting down and writing a series of children's books yourself?
Well, my focus for the last 36 years has been on sharing stories, sharing other people's stories with kids. And, you know, I guess it was a matter of time and timing. I have completed my first children's book, and it will be released this coming October.
I'm glad I asked that question. You were, of course, part of the television series Roots that was maybe one of the greatest conveners in the history of the medium. Mm. And even with Reading Rainbow, there was a beauty in it being a half-hour TV show that meant that when you were watching it, you weren't doing something else.
Yeah.
In reinventing Reading Rainbow digitally, do you have to take into account the different way that people, that kids are using media?
Absolutely. However, if you want to reach kids, you need to be in the digital realm. Look, the television was the technology that we used back in the 80s to reach kids because that's where they were. And we want to be effective with this message. We want to be effective with this mission. And so you need to be willing to meet kids where they are and then take them where you want them to go.
And so this is to say that as much as you might like to produce another half-hour block, it's realistically not what kids are about these days.
Well, we are actually contemplating what it might look like and feel like in today's world to create another, let's call it a half-hour version of Reading Rainbow, where it would be broadcast. You know, we're sort of trying to figure that out. There are a lot of options these days, and I'm not unalterably opposed to it, so long as it brings something additional to the table in terms of our ability to reach kids.
Well, and how do you evaluate the work that you did and still do with Reading Rainbow versus the other aspects of your career, the acting, the voice work, the other things that make you who you are?
Well, that's a boy. As much as I love acting and directing and being a storyteller in the visual medium, there isn't anything that I do or have done that I think fills me with a deep sense of purpose that Reading Rainbow has. Currently, we have kids coming to the Reading Rainbow app and reading about 200,000 books a week. And what that means is that we have proven our belief that we can get kids to come to this very engaging technology to read, not just play games, but read. And that's a game changer for me.
As someone who has become kind of an expert in the area of reading education and literacy education, do you think is there some part of the conversation that we're not having about education in this country right now that you think needs to be addressed?
I'm encouraged that we're leaving No Child Left Behind. I'm encouraged that we're addressing ourselves to the whole child and to connecting the reading that a child does to all of the different subject matter. I'm wildly encouraged by the success of the Kickstarter campaign that Americans still do care about child literacy. I'm wildly excited that there seems to be a couple of generations of adults now who grew up on Reading Rainbow who really do believe that succeeding generations need Reading Rainbow or something like Reading Rainbow to encourage them in this direction. I feel like we are cracking the nut on what has been a real abysmal chapter in the story called Educating America's Kids.
You think we have turned a corner?
I think we are on our way to turning the corner. I think that we are making much better decisions and providing much better opportunities. I really genuinely believe that we can revolutionize the way we teach our children with this technology. And we just have to really be smart about it and bold and imaginative.
How much of the real LeVar Burton are we seeing in that role? And you know, how do you explain how you bring the real LeVar Burton to all the acting roles that you played through the years?
Wow. I don't know. It's not something that I think about a lot or am conscious of. But I will say that I have spent the better part of my life trying to identify what I believe to be my authentic self. And as an artist, I think that we are predisposed to want to share that authenticity. It is our stock in trade. It is, at the end of the day, that which we have to offer. And I've been pretty fortunate, very, very lucky, enormously blessed to have been able to express myself as an actor, as a director, as a writer, as a children's television host. And I hope that I am always able to bring an authentic part of myself to those expressions.
And so here's the question my daughter wanted me to ask. Did you have a favorite experience in all the field trips that you took for making Reading Rainbow?
Wow. So many.
She desperately wants it to be the whale watch.
Whale watching was unbelievably fun. And that's the thing. I mean, look, I think my job as the host of Reading Rainbow is the best job I've ever had. And I'm the chief engineer of the Starship Enterprise. So whale watching, absolutely. I think of going to the volcano, to being on the precipice of Kilauea as it was in full eruption. I flew an airplane for the first time, learned how to dive for Reading Rainbow. The experiences that I've had have enriched my life immeasurably.
Well, LeVar Burton, you have given us a great window into your world. And first of all, thank you for spending some time with us on Lake Effect, and thank you for all your years of Reading Rainbow.
Well, my pleasure.
LeVar Burton was the host of public television's Reading Rainbow for 23 years. He's now co-founder and curator-in-chief of the digital edition of Reading Rainbow, which features a website, an app, and a classroom curriculum. He'll speak later this month at the Sharp Literacy Annual Luncheon in Milwaukee, and there is a link to more information about that from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Another big name is keynoting an event this week in Milwaukee. Wisconsin native Butch Vig talks about the music industry and a new album by Garbage, the band he co-founded 20 years ago, when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.
I'm only happy when it rains.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. The 2014 Yellowphone Music Conference kicks off tomorrow evening in Milwaukee. The annual gathering offers a showcase for unsigned, mainly Midwestern bands in front of music industry executives. One of those appearing for the first time at any music conference is Viroqua native Butch Vig. Vig is best known as being a musician and a producer. He's the drummer for the multi-platinum Grammy-nominated band Garbage, which came out of Madison in the early 1990s. He's also won awards for producing albums from bands from Nirvana to Green Day to the Foo Fighters. Vig will give the keynote at Yellowphone on Friday morning. First, though, he joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North from his office in Los Angeles and explained why this conference was a good fit for him.
I like it that it's obviously being centered in Milwaukee, it's focused on the Midwest. And what I really like about it is I am excited that it's sort of going back to square one, almost a grassroots start of where the festival, some of the big successful music conferences now started 20 or 25 years ago. And it's really trying to cater to young, unsigned bands and help them navigate the music business and to get information and make connections with the music industry and try to just help them get a leg forward.
Is that why you decided to participate? Because, as you said, this is the first one you've done.
I think the reason I got excited was Jeff Kaslitz asked, and Scott, asked me, and initially I said, I don't know if I really want to do that. When they asked me if I wanted to do a keynote speech, I kind of cringed because I don't like giving speeches. And then Jeff said, well, it doesn't have to be a formal speech. It can be sort of a Q&A. We can just riff off each other and talk about the state of music and where it is and where we see it going and just get involved with participation with the audience. So, I don't think it's going to be scripted. We're just going to kind of go off the cuff. But it's a chance for me to be able to share some of my experience to a new generation of musicians and songwriters. And I'm really lucky that I had over 30 years that I've had this long career. And I just feel like it's a good thing to do, to be able to go back to where I grew up and share that experience with people.
It's changed so much, though, in those 30 years. I mean, my God, it's a seismic shift or a number of seismic shifts in the way the music industry works and how bands get noticed and how they actually get signed, or if they get signed, if they do it on their own. From when you first started, What changes have you seen that you think have profoundly affected the way, you know, new music gets to audiences?
When I first started out, the music industry was a mystery. Recording was a mystery. Going into a studio was a mystery. What is publishing? I didn't know anything about it. And it seemed like there were all these obstacles you had to overcome in order to try and navigate a career for yourself. And now, with the wealth of information out there on the internet and digital distribution, musicians and young artists are much more self-empowered. But there still are a lot of questions and things that I think working with people who have experience can help them navigate. Like, a lot of people can figure out how to make recordings now. You can make a really good recording on your laptop in your bedroom. But how do you promote that, and how do you market that, and what's the smartest way to do that? So there's still a lot of questions that young bands have and can use help with. And for some acts, I think they're going to want to remain very independent and probably just self-release it or do it on their own terms. But a lot of other artists, I think, still need and want help from established management, from established labels and promotion, you know, traditional promotion. So I think there's no direct single path anyone can follow, and I think that's one of the things that's exciting about the state of the world that we live in now, the music industry that we live in now, is that there are all these opportunities, and I think it's just trying to figure out how to, you know, how to use them to your advantage. People want good music, but with the advent of the digital technology and the internet, there's probably 5 million bands out there now, or 10 million bands, I don't know how many. 30 years ago, because it was a lot harder, you sort of had to really fight your way and be good to a certain extent to get heard. And now anybody can be heard. So what it's done is it's kind of given us a gigantic sea awash in mediocrity. You know, there's so much music you have to wade through sometimes to find something that you love. That being said, a great song or a great artist is going to find an audience. They are going to rise above that gigantic sea of music. And so if you're good, you're going to find an audience. And it's much easier now for an artist to do than it was 30 years ago.
Well, okay, you're good and you can find the audience. Can you make a living at it?
That's the million-dollar question. I mean, I think that's one of the things we're going to talk about at the Yellow Foam Conference is how do you make a living these days? Obviously, CD sales are way down, and even with services like Spotify, I mean, it's great to get airplay on there, but their percentage that they pay for a million streams is just, you know, unbelievably low. So you're not going to really be able to afford a career doing that. But if you can get your music out there and heard, maybe you can get it licensed in a TV show or a film or a commercial. As I said, because it's being consumed in so many different ways now, all these ad agencies want music and licensing agencies, and that's, I know a lot of bands that's where they're making their living now. There are avenues that artists are realizing they have to pursue rather than just try to rely on traditional record sales.
How does that change how you put an album together? And you've done this both from a musician side and a producer side. Do you have to think about making your music in a different way?
Well, what I've seen as a producer is a lot of new bands have to be very, very efficient with how they record. There's just not the sales from expected CD sales to justify spending $300,000 or $400,000 or $500,000 on a album. And, you know, maybe that was a long time coming because obviously through probably in the 70s and the 80s, there was a lot of excess on, definitely in the music business, on promotion and you know, catering to every whim of a superstar artist. But everyone's had to get really kind of lean and tight and focused. And I think in some ways that's good. There are so many ways to record now and make a great recording. But one of the things that I think is a bit sad is a lot of the studios have been forced to close because of lack of business. My studio, Smart Studios, being one of them. You know, we just couldn't keep our doors open because we weren't getting enough business, even though we were offering rates that were dirt cheap for bands to come in there. Even if we were saying, come on in for a couple hundred dollars a day to record, which is nothing really, they could still do it for free at home on their laptops. So one of the sad things is the great spaces, a lot of the great studios are slowly closing the doors, and what's going to happen is a lot of artists are never going to get that chance to record in a really great recording studio. You know, they're going to be recording on their laptop in their basement.
Yeah, and that's something that we lose because there is a sound and then there's an energy and there's it's almost ineffable. I don't know that you could necessarily put your finger on it. There might be some acoustical things you could point to and say, yes, it's like designed this way. But, you know, I think we as listeners lose something we might not be able to put our finger on.
I agree. And I think part of that is the sound of people playing in a room,
mm-hmm.
which is how the earliest recordings were ever made. A group of musicians stand around a microphone and they record a performance into it. And that's a tangible feel of the energy of the way they're interacting and the way that their fingers are expressing the instruments and the way their voices are uniting. And obviously a studio these days, digital, not only can you create anything, but there's all these presets that have manufactured, you know, already pre-made drum sounds and bass sounds and keyboards and guitar sounds. And so I think what I've heard, a lot of that starts to sound generic, and it doesn't have as much character as, you know, sometimes I would prefer. You lose some of that magical quality of getting people into a room and capturing a vibe.
Yeah, where everybody's excited to do it, and you just have that energy that it's why people go to live shows, because there's nothing else like it.
Yeah, and that's an experience you share, you
right.
know, and it becomes a communal thing, and that's why great live bands are always probably going to have a career, because you can't necessarily duplicate that on a record, and you can't share that experience in an MP3 file.
How does the fact that you are an accomplished musician and, you know, been in any number of bands and done that, how does that feed your producing?
Well, I think because I started out as a drummer and then slowly became a songwriter and got interested in engineering and then producing, I've always had sort of a view of being a musician first, and I think I'm very cognizant of the fact of what it's like to be in a band, what that dynamic means, you know, interacting with people on a personal level and a psychological level. And to me, a big part of producing is that. It's the psychological aspect. It's not just how do you get a snare drum sound. Any good engineer can get a good snare drum sound. And at the end of the day, an audience doesn't really respond to the snare drum sound. They want to hear a performance. They want to grab onto something emotional. And so much of that, I think, at least for me when I'm in the studio, is trying to tap into the sort of the psyche of the band or the artist I'm working with and figure out what it is that makes them unique and powerful. And when am I feeling this performance? And that's something you can't really teach. You just have to sort of figure it out and understand it in a way. And I would say, you know, when I first started out, for me, recording was probably 80% technical and 20% more psychological. And I, to some extent, I'd say it's almost flipped completely the opposite. It really is so much of it for me is getting into an artist's head and understanding what their vibe is, you know, and then trying to really pull out great performances.
Well, speaking of your musical side of things, I have to say I loved the most recent Garbage album.
Right on.
And was it fun to get back in the studio with a band?
Well, when we got back together for Not Your Kind of People, we'd been on a 7-year break, and I think we were all kind of nervous just to see what would happen. And the good thing is having that long break, any sort of tension or band trauma that sometimes happens, even with Garbage, that it all dissipated. And we kind of felt like we had a fresh start. And because we were no longer on a label and we had changed management, no one even knew what we were doing, so we didn't really feel any pressure. And there was no timeline or agenda at the time either. And I think because of that, not feeling any pressure, the songs just came really quickly. And we sort of embraced who we are as a band. We didn't want to try and reinvent how we sound, you know. How should Garbage sound 7 years after our last record? We just defaulted to what we like to do best, the sensibility of how we play and write together. And for better or for worse, we do have a sound, and that's part of it is just what we like sonically and just in terms of how we play as musicians and how Shirley sings. And And we kind of look at that now as a badge of honor that that garbage has a sound, you know, because there are so many bands out there, like we talked about earlier, and millions of bands, and to have a sonic fingerprint, you know, sort of an identity of how you sound is an important thing these days. So we embrace that, and I think in a way that freed us up. And then we went out and did almost 150 shows on tour, and that was eye-opening, but also really, really fun. And we're gearing up for a 20th anniversary next year, and we're probably going to be doing some shows in the summer and the fall. And we just started a new record. We hope to have a new Garbage record finished by the end of this year. It'll be out sometime later next year.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's great news. Are you planning to do the tour here? Because would love to have you in the studio.
Well, I'm sure we will. I mean, we always usually come back and play in Milwaukee and play Madison, Chicago, Minneapolis. You know, but being from the Midwest, we have a lot of fans back there and just friends and family. So it's always a real treat for us to come back there and spend some time. So I'm sure we will. We don't really have any. It's too early to have any anything set in concrete yet in terms of when that will be, but I'd love to come on the show, Bonnie, when we're back there. That would be fun.
Oh, let's plan it. That would be fantastic. And I also have to ask another Wisconsin question, of course.
Sure.
I know the schedule isn't in your favor when you're here, but are you going to go up to Lambeau?
I get in Thursday night, and then I'm giving the keynote speech with Jeff on Friday morning. And I tried to see if I could go to Seattle to see the game and then catch a red eye.
You are hardcore.
It got too hectic. So but when we get in Thursday night, we're going to have some sort of Packer party. We're going to be watching somewhere. I think Jeff and I land like at 5 o'clock and the game's on at 7. So we'll definitely be holed up somewhere. I'm a hardcore Packer fan.
I know.
It's the only sort of sport that I'm really kind of crazy about, but it's really for me it's all about the Packers. So I'm excited. I think they're gonna have a pretty good team again this year.
It looks like it. Yeah, I think people are pretty excited, and you know, kind of the buzz, of course, it never goes down, but it's kind of come back up.
You know, years ago our guitar tech in Garbage, Chad Zamish, and I wrote a song, Go Pack Go. We sort of wrote it on the tour bus when we were in Europe somewhere. And then we made a copy and sent it up to Lambeau, and they play it from time. We went to a game, and they play it from time to time in the game, and it's just such a thrill to be in Lambeau and hear a song you recorded being blasted over the PA. It's a real trip, man.
I was going to say, here you are, you know, you produce Nirvana, you know, you're in Garbage, and what really gets you is the fact that Lambeau Field plays your song.
I can die a happy man.
Your life is complete. That is fantastic. Well, you know, Butch, I cannot thank you enough for taking time out. I know you've got a busy schedule, but I really appreciate you talking with us. And I'm going to hold you to that. Please come on the show.
I will. That'll be great, Bonnie.
All right. And we'll see you at the conference.
We'll see you at the conference.
Viroqua native Butch Vig is one of the founders of the band Garbage, founded in Madison in 1993, and also an award-winning music producer. He'll give the keynote talk at the Yellowphone Music Conference later this week in Milwaukee. He spoke with Bonnie North. We'll hear from one of the bands hoping for big things from this week's conference when Lake Effect continues on WUWM.
Prompted to go out and get what I wanted, but I didn't even know it. When I finally decided to go out and catch her, didn't go too far to fetch her, and for once I didn't blow it.
More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. Before the break, we spoke with musician and producer Butch Vig, who delivers the keynote at this year's Yellowphone Music Conference in Milwaukee Friday morning. The conference provides unsigned bands with a chance to play in front of record company representatives, and a number of area bands will take the stage, including Waukesha's Ian and the Dream. They've been around since 2008, when frontman Ian Ash and bass player Chivo met in high school. Following their self-titled EP from several years back, the band's new album, California Cauliflower, comes out this week. Two-thirds of Ian and the Dream stopped by the Lake Effect Performance Studio yesterday to talk with Bonnie North and play some music, including this older song of theirs called Annabelle.
Sure enough, things turn out for the better. Just like the time that I met her, I could see it in her eyes. I don't have to try hard to make it perfect. We both know that it's worth it. A sweet surprise. Talking about my Annabelle, I never knew all of the good things that we had in store. Everything's just going swell, and I know that I can look forward to so much more. People say that young love is something you can't be sure of, but I am certain this will go on.
Ian and the Dream, or at least two-thirds of Ian and the Dream, in Lake Effect's performance studio with Annabelle. Ian and Shiva, welcome.
Thanks, you.
That was just great. And tell me about this song, because it's got a little bit of a special place in your repertoire.
Oh, sure. Well, not only was it one of the oldest songs that we still do as a band, but it dates back because it was the first song that Butch Vig, who I'll be seeing at Yellow Foam Music Conference this Friday, he heard it several years ago and said he liked it a lot. So he's like, ooh, catchy song.
Talk about something that's a feel-good moment.
Oh, it was a very feel-good moment. I was at one of his gigs. He plays in this band, the Know-It-All Boyfriends, when he's not busy with garbage. And I recall a moment during that show he took a break and kind of put the song on in his car and called it catchy, and I'll never forget that.
And so, it's been in the set ever since.
Wouldn't that be something? Yeah. So, Ian, the last time you were here, you were by yourself because the rest of the band was elsewhere doing something, and a lot has happened.
Yeah.
Since then, that's been a couple of years, and you've got a brand new album, which we're going to hear some music of. Tell me about it.
Well, yeah, this record's called California Cauliflower. We've been working on it. We spent about a year making it. And, you know, it was just one of those things where, okay, well, you know, we had made a couple of EPs. And when I was in here last year, you even said to me, hey, come back when you have the full length. And I remember at the time thinking, well, we just made an EP. You know, when's that going to be? But then our producer, Stephen Short, who had won Grammys with several bands, he, you know, got cancer, and we decided we couldn't make another EP with him. You know, he was recovering from cancer. And so that's kind of when I decided to set work on this record. You know, I kind of started making it in our own home studio, and we just kind of chipped away on the old chipping block for about the better part of a year there, and this is what we got.
How is it working as it being your own producer? And Chivo, Chip, you know, jump in on this. You know, you guys have been the band,
yeah,
and now you're also having to have producers' ears on as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was fun. You know, I mean, I felt like we could have only done that for one thing. You know, I could have only produced this record if I had worked with Steven. You know, if it weren't for Steven and everything I had learned from him, I mean, I wouldn't have been able to do this. So that's one thing. But, I mean, it's fun. You know, I think, you know, Chivo's a guy who's pretty honest with me. If he doesn't like something I do, or I'm pretty honest with him.
It's like, nope, that's not working.
Let's change that. Yeah.
Exactly.
So it's pretty natural.
Yeah. And for me, it was just so comfortable recording this way. Basically, throughout the entire time we've been recording together, we go into a studio, we spend a lot of money, we're kind of rushed through it, and With this, we just had all the time in the world to do it how we wanted to. And it was just the most comfortable experience ever. And it's all on that record. It's just, we put a lot of love into that.
Yeah, time.
A lot of time, a lot of love.
That's exactly it. Time really became the invisible producer in the room. Time was that producer who a few months later could be like, why don't you try it this way?
Exactly.
Or why don't you choose?
Yeah.
And that's true. You know, and we have to lay this down. Let's move on.
Yeah. You had some time to think about it versus you have a day to do it and then you got to get to the next song the next day. And it's just like, no, we get to focus on one song for a long time. So it was awesome. It's how the record should be made, in my opinion. It was great.
But did you miss that outside voice? Did you miss somebody coming in that wasn't part of the band saying, you know, I really hear this? It's like an editor for a writer, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's a great question, Bonnie. I mean, like, just because I produced the record myself and, you know, we had the guys helping with arrangements, I mean, outside of that, you know, I might throw it on for my dad or throw it on. You know, we actually had Jason Klagstad, who is over at KNE Entertainment, K-Nation. He's been mentoring us lately, and he was a big help. He came over and just kind of is like, wow, this is really great. He's like, can I just see how you're hearing this? I'd love to see your final mixing session. And he offered a little bit of input, you know, certainly not a producer's level, but just, you know, his input certainly helped, you know, just give me more perspective on things and, you know, kind of affirmed that we were going in a good direction. And he had some nice little polishing ideas.
Little tweaks.
Yeah.
Made it sweeter.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So now you're launching this at Yellowphone, right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, so this is actually happening here in Milwaukee with everything. I mean, I'm holding a copy, in a hot off-the-press copy in my hands.
Wrapped up
and all nice and sweet. So tell me the sequence of events. Is this you're going to play at the conference and then you're going to have a party, or is it just the party, or?
Well, the conference itself is really neat. You know, they have a lot of cool business people, and you go talk in panels and meet these great people who have accomplished so much, such as Butch Vig. And, you know, and then, but as for our CD release party, that is part of the showcases of Yellowphone. So they have some of Milwaukee's finest artists, or what they think, you know, are some of the better artists. Not, you know, they come to Milwaukee and they have these different showcases throughout the East Side. So, there's a handful of venues participating. We're playing at Evolution, Gastropong, formerly Spin. And that's just part of the showcases. So it's a live show from us, 12:30 in the morning.
And rock and roll hours, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But it's cool to be closing out the night and headlining. We're thankful for that. So it's a live release party at 12:30 in the morning at Evolution. And that's when we'll have the CDs available for the first time.
Okay. Well, we're going to get a little preview from this. Now, I realize you're missing Brian,
yes,
the drummer.
Missing the drummer.
And this is sort of an acoustic version of it. But we are going to hear a couple of songs now from the album. And tell me about this first one.
This one's called Steppin' on My Shoes. It's the lead-off single from the new album. And, in fact, we'll be dropping a music video for it this week. And we're pretty proud that it's kind of been taken off on SoundCloud lately, like 25,000 plays in just a couple weeks that we've had it up or so. So we're pretty pleased with that. And this is our first single, Steppin' on My Shoes.
All right. Ian and the Dream in Lake Effects Performance Studio C1.
Got three guitars and the crowd was bouncing like Neil Armstrong's landing. I knew music best. I danced each beat and wrist, and soon I found you on the floor commanding. You didn't know the dance. You moved like Jello. I like how you advanced towards this fellow. Next thing I know, you're stepping on my shoes. Cause it's one you wanna hold me, two you wanna roll me. I step in twos, but you're sitting duck and I'm a rolling chuck. Stepping on my shoes. Cause it's a three you wanna lead and a four you're on the floor and I like being stuck on you. Such a steady beat, you could not move your feet, and yet it's sweet to know you feel fine with me. We move like yin and yang, and
every word you sang. I took your breath in like a new beginning. I lost our track of time, just like now I replay it in my mind. Wonder how I could get away when you're stepping on my shoes. As it's the one you wanna hold me to, you wanna roll me. I step in twos, but you're a sitting duck, and I'm a rolling chuck. Stepping on my shoes, as it's the three you wanna lead and four you're on the floor, and I like being stuck on you. I won't let no one steal our time. This dance is only yours and mine. Even if it can't be transcribed, we know just what to do. It's only me and you. Stepping on my shoes, cause it's the one you wanna hold me to, you wanna roll me. I step in twos, but you're a sitting duck and I'm a rolling chuck. Stepping on my shoes, cause it's three you wanna lead and four you're on the floor, and I like being stuck on you. I like being stuck on you. I like being stuck on you. I like being stuck on. I like being stuck on you. I like being stuck on. I like being stuck on you. I like being stuck on. I like being stuck on you. I like being stuck on you.
Stepping on my shoes, Ian and the Dream, or at least two-thirds of them, in Lake Effects Performance Studio. Gentlemen, that's great.
Thank you.
And that's off the new album, California Cauliflower, which is being released this Friday at the Yellowphone Music Conference. And Ian, what do conferences like this do for bands like you guys, where you are in your career?
Well, it kind of used to be that if you wanted any kind of chance to get face-to-face with these kind of professionals who have, you know, been presidents of labels or big record producers or whatever, you would have had to go to South by Southwest in Texas. And that's why it's really neat that some cool people in the scene that, you know, are dominant in the business here in Milwaukee put together Yellowphone so that musicians like us in Milwaukee don't have to, you know, get a huge audience to come to Austin in order to get the attention of people, or that we don't have to go to Austin to get in front of, you know, these people's faces and get into small rooms with them and hear some of their business secrets, you know. So this is just a really neat way for musicians to connect with some of these people. And, you know, we were lucky enough to be kind of connected with some of these people already going into it. So it'll be really nice to see people like Butch and everyone at the conference. We're really looking forward to it.
Do you hope for some sort of record contract out of it, or is this more of a meet and greet and kind of picking people's brains sort of thing?
Well, you know, you shoot for the stars. You know, I think anything could happen, you know, if Butch loves our showcase, you know. You think anything could happen. We're certainly working for a record contract all the time, you know. Getting us, you know, things like this and doing all the press and radio and TV on our own. So far, all without a publicist. And as soon as we get that, it should take off even more. But, yeah, the record contract's always kind of the goal at the end. It's kind of the reason. You know, the music's really the reason, because we love the music. But, of course, we want that record contract. And you never know what could happen, you know, if we really knock someone's socks off at this conference.
Well, you know, the music's the reason, but you also have to make a living.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know, you want to be able to pay the rent and eat and, you know, and that
kind
sort of thing. Kind of, yeah. If you want to keep making music, you kind of have to do that. And I think it's that always that balancing act.
Yeah.
You know, particularly with young bands, new talent, you know, you've got the passion, but you need the financial support, too.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So once this happens, and let's hope for good things, let's, you know, the things
you
kick off. But I'm assuming you've got things lined up no matter what happens at Yellowphone. You've
right.
got, like, tours coming up. What's happening?
Right. Well, we're getting a publicist, and we are going to be heading down to Chicago and building more of a regional tour. So that's cool. We got that going. And we're just excited to launch this album, you know, to the world. You know, we're going to be releasing it everywhere, and we're excited to see some fans in Europe and other places online even sharing it with their friends. So we'll see where the buzzes grow with those places too, and then build it and, you know, go as many places as we can with it that are
hopefully
feasible,
take it on tour out.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be awesome.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's the last song we're going to hear? Because you have to play us out with something, and sure. I'm assuming it's going to be from the new album. I'm hoping.
Absolutely. This one is the first song we finished from the new album, the one that kind of started it all, the first one we worked on. It's called Girl from California.
If I could quick chime in quick, we actually started, or actually I laid the bass track down for this on July 4th, 2013, and that was kind of, that was the first song we did for the bass for the record, and basically, Ian and I had a big joke that was us declaring independence from the big recording studios. We're just doing this in our basement, you know, taking our time with it. So it was a great moment to remember for me.
Independence Day, declaring independence.
Absolutely. Absolutely. On your five-string bass,
yes.
Which I have to comment on because that's a handsome instrument.
Thank you. Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah, and it's got a great sound.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Yeah.
That's my baby. I've had this for a long time.
So it's unusual to see the five string. Usually you see four strings.
Yep. I actually use a modulus flea bass as well. It's a very pretty bass. But this is my main squeeze. I love this guy. He's my
right.
five string.
All right. Well, let us hear Going Out, Girl from California from Ian and the Dream, California Cauliflower. And Ian and Chivo, I can't thank you enough for stopping by. And best of luck at Yellowphone.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ronnie. Thanks for having us.
Girl from California, I'd like to get to know ya. Throw you on my shoulder, talk to me now. Girl from California, come check out my show ya. Know my band will roll ya. Sing to me now.
Ian Ash and Chivo are two-thirds of the Waukesha-based band Ian and the Dream. They released their new album called California Cauliflower this Friday at the Yellowphone Music Conference in Milwaukee. They spoke with Bonnie North, and our interview was engineered by John Strelecki. That's all for the Wednesday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow, and of course, every weekday morning at 10, right here on Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're your NPR station in Milwaukee. Coming your way at 12 noon today, it's Here and Now with the latest news from NPR and WBUR in Boston, but right now, it's Fresh Air. It's 11 o'clock.
Though I'm on the road, yeah, make me feel at home. You'll sing to me now. Girl, what you know about this place that you call home? Do girls from California ever feel alone?